pandemic. Together, we must educate ourselves and others and be eager to understand race, systemic racism, and racial justice in Canada and elsewhere. Remember, whoever, wherever.
Pledge resistance!
What's up? This is Saul Williams chilling here in Montreal, here on CKUT. Peace.
We pledge alliance with those who have undergone attack for voicing opposition to the war.
Good evening and welcome to the November 9th edition of Dromotext. Tonight we have two poets for you, Joy Harjo and Sherman Alexie, both of whom were recorded by the University of California television series, and we've taken from their lunchtime poetry series. So here they are, Joy Harjo and Alexie Sherman.
I'm going to start out with a piece, a prayer actually, written for a memorial for Audre Lorde, one of our finest. It's called Reconciliation, and it comes out of thinking about where we are at the end of the century and where we're going, because we're all here together at a time of incredible possibility as well as incredible destruction. Reconciliation. One. We gather at the shore of all knowledge as peoples who were put here by a God who wanted relatives. This God was lonely for touch and imagined herself as a woman with children to suckle, to sing with, to continue the web of the terrifyingly beautiful cosmos of her womb. This God became a father who wished for others to walk beside him in the belly of creation. This God laughed and cried with us as a sister at the sweet tragedy of our predicament, foolish humans, or built a fire as our brother to keep us warm. This God who grew to love us became our lover, sharing tables of food enough for everyone in this whole world. Two. O sun, moon, stars, our other relatives, peering at us from the inside of God's house, walk with us as we climb into the next century, naked but for the stories we have of each other. Keep us from giving up in this land of nightmares, which is also the land of miracles. We sing our song, which we've been promised has no beginning or end. Three. All acts of kindness are lights in the war for justice. Four. We gather up these strands broken from the web of life. They shiver with our love as we call them the names of our relatives and carry them to our home made of the four directions and sing of the South, where we were feasted and were given new clothes. Of the West, where we gave up the best of us as food for the battle. Of the North, where we cried because we were forsaken by our dreams. Of the East, because return to us is the spirit of all that we love. Thank you. And violence seems to be a prevalent theme in the history of this land. People are looking around saying, well, you know, where's this coming from? Well, you know, this country, as we know it, is built on violence, on the blood of our peoples. Native peoples in this country were 100% of the population. Now we're 0.5%. And I'm going to tell one story. Often, as I drive around this country or fly around this country to speak in different places, the people I come into contact with most often are taxi drivers. I hear a lot of stories that way. And this next piece comes out of one of those stories. I was in a downtown Chicago hotel room when I called home and was shocked by the story of an Albuquerque taxi driver who was stabbed in the neighborhood I had just moved from a few weeks before. The driver dragged himself to the porch of a home that may have been the house that had been a sweet harbor. He died there. I knew many of the taxi drivers because I often took a taxi to the airport. I fearfully imagined the faces and voices of all of them. I could smell this tragedy, though I was far from home. I imagined being able to do something had I been there. Instead, I was throwing up as I imagined washing his blood off my porch, calling his relatives. Did he have daughters or sons? Who told his mother? How would they bury him? That morning, I took a taxi from the hotel to O'Hare with a taxi driver who introduced himself to me as Rami. I was still shaken with the story of the death of the Albuquerque taxi driver. I have no explanation for senseless acts of violence. The weight was pressing me. Rami and I began talking. As an Indian woman in this country, I often find I have much in common with many of the immigrants from other colonized lands who come here to make a living, often as taxi drivers. And he told me of his friend, another taxi driver, who was killed in similar circumstances as the Albuquerque driver. And this is called Letter from the End of the 20th Century. You have to imagine little reggae with this. We play this with my band. I shared a half hour of my life this morning with Rami, an Igbo man from northern Nigeria who drove me in his taxi to the airport. Rami told of his friend who one morning around 7, a morning much like this one, was filling his taxi with gas. He was imagining home, a village whose memories had given him sustenance to study through his degree and would keep him going one more year until he had the money he needed to return. As the sun broke through the gray morning, he heard his mother tell him the way she had told him when he was a young boy, how the sun had once been an Igbo and returned every morning to visit relatives. These memories were the coat that kept him warm on the streets of ice. He was interrupted by a young man who asked him for money, a young man who was like so many he saw on his daily journey onto the street to collect fares. "Oh, no, sorry, man. I don't have anything I can give you," he said as he patted the pockets of his worn slacks, his thin nylon jacket. He saved every penny because he knew when he returned he'd be taking care of a family several houses large. He turned back to the attention of filling his gas tank. What a beautiful morning, almost warm, and the same sun, the same Igbo, looking down on him in the streets of the labyrinth, far, far from home. And just like that, he was gone, from a gunshot wound at the back of his head, the hit of a casual murderer. As we near the concrete plains of O'Hare, I imagine the spirit of Rami's friend at the door of his mother's house, the bag of dreams in his hands dripping with blood. His mother's tears make a river of red stars to an empty moon. The whole village mourns with her. The ritual of tears and drums summon the ancestors who carry his spirit into the next world. There, he can still hear the drums of his relatives as they accompany him on his journey. He must settle the story of his murder before joining his ancestors, or he will come back a ghost. The smallest talking drum is an insistent heart, leads his spirit to the killer, a young Jamaican immigrant who was traced to his apartment because his shirt of blood was found by the police thrown off in the alley with his driver's license in the pocket. He searches for his murderer in the bowels of Chicago and finds him shivering in a cramped jail cell. He could hang him or knife him, and it would be called suicide. It would be the easiest thing. But his mother's grief moves his heart. He hears the prayers of the young man's mother, and there is always a choice, even after death. He gives the young man his favorite name and calls him his brother. The young killer is then no longer shamed, but filled with remorse and cries all the cries he has stored for 1,000 years. He learns to love himself as he never could, because his enemy, who has every reason to destroy him, loves him. That's the story that follows me everywhere and won't let me sleep. From Tallahassee grounds to Chicago to my home near the Rio Grande, it sustains me through these tough distances. This next piece is another story from the labyrinth. It's called Deer Dancer. And it comes from a story told me years ago when I was standing in an Indian bar in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And it was one of those nights that, one of those really cold, blizzardy nights that no one in their right mind would step outside in. But here in this little bar, the only place open in that city, this little band of stragglers, people looking for home, waiting for morning, playing pool, playing the jukebox, when in walked the most beautiful woman in the world. And this is my version of what happened. Deer Dancer. Nearly everyone had left that bar in the middle of winter except the hardcore. It was the coldest night of the year. Every place shut down, but not us. Of course, we noticed when she came in. We were Indian ruins. She was the end of beauty. No one knew her, the stranger whose tribe we recognized, her family related to deer, if that's who she was, a people accustomed to hearing songs in pine trees and making them hearts. The woman inside the woman who is to dance naked in the bar of Misfits Blue, dear magic. Henry Jack, who could not survive a sober day, thought she was Buffalo Calf Woman, come back, passed out, his head by the toilet. All night he dreamed a dream he couldn't say. The next day he borrowed money, went home, then sent back the money I lent. Now that's a miracle. Some people see vision in a burned tortilla, some in the face of a woman. This is the bar of broken survivors, the club of shotgun, knife wound of poison by culture. We who were taught not to stare drank our beer. The players gossiped down their cues. Someone put a quarter in the jukebox to relive despair. Richard's wife dove to kill her. We had to hold her back, empty her pockets of knives and diaper pins, buy her 2 beers to keep her still while Richard secretly bought the beauty a drink. How do I say it? In this language, there are no words for how the real world collapses. I could say it in my own and the sacred mounds would come into focus, but I couldn't take it in this dingy envelope. So I look at the stars in this strange city, frozen to the back of the sky, the only promises that ever make sense. My brother-in-law hung out with white people, went to law school with a perfect record, then quit. Said you can keep your laws, your words, and practice law on the street with his hands. He jimmied to the proverbial dream girl, the face of the moon, while the players racked a new game. He bragged to us, he told her magic words, and that's when she broke, became human. But we all heard his bar voice crack. What's a girl like you doing in a place like this? That's what I'd like to know. What are we doing in a place like this? You would know she could hear only what she wanted to, don't we all? Left the drink of betrayal, Richard bought her at the bar. What was she on? We all wanted some. Put a quarter in the juke. We all take risks stepping into thin air. Our ceremonies didn't predict this, or we expected more. I had to tell you this, for the baby inside the girl sealed up with a lick of hope and swimming in the praise of nations. This is not a rooming house, but a dream of winter falls and the deer who portrayed the relatives of strangers. The way back is deer breath on icy windows. The next dance, none of us predicted. She borrowed a chair for the stairway to heaven and stood on a table of names and danced in the room of children without shoes. You picked a fine time to leave me, Lucille, with four hungry children and a crop in the field. And then she took off her clothes. She shook loose memory, waltzed with the empty lover we'd all become. She was the myth, slipped down through dream time. The promise of feast we all knew was coming. The deer who crossed through knots of a curse to find us. She was no slouch, and neither were we watching. The music ended, and so does the story. I wasn't there. But I imagined her like this, not a stained red dress with tape on her heels, but the deer who entered our dream in white dawn, breathed mist into pine trees, her fawn a blessing of meat, the ancestors who never left. And this next piece comes out of that same landscape and winter and darkness. Once upon a time, I was a student at the Iowa Writers' Workshop in the middle of Iowa. And in a way, that was one of the hardest times in my life because I came up against, I suppose, a major conflict that I think as a Native woman who is a Western writer, whatever that means, an American writer, comes up against when it hits Puritanism. Maybe that's. But I survived it, several of us survived it. And one day I was flying over it, looking down at the snow and remembering those 80 below wind chill factor days and thinking about how in the midst of all of it, every once in a while, there would be these moments when you least expected it, these moments of incredible, nearly unbearable grace. And this is about one of those moments. Grace. I think of wind and her wild ways, the year we had nothing to lose and lost it anyway in the cursed country of the fox. We still talk about that winter. How the cold froze imaginary buffalo in the stuffed horizon of snowbanks. The haunting voices of the starved and mutilated broke fences crashed our thermostat dreams, and we couldn't stand it one more time. So once again, we lost a winter in stubborn memory, walked through cheap apartment walls, skated through fields of ghosts into a town that never wanted us in the epic search for grace. Like coyote, like rabbit, we could not contain our terror and clowned our way through a season of false midnights. We had to swallow that town with laughter so it would go down easy as honey. And one morning, as the sun struggled to break ice, and our dreams had found us with coffee and pancakes in a truck stop along Highway 80. We found grace. I could say Grace was a woman with time on her hands, or a white buffalo escaped from memory. But in that dingy light, it was a promise of balance. We once again understood the talk of animals, and spring was lean and hungry with the hope of children and corn. I would like to say, with grace, we picked ourselves up and walked into the spring thaw. We didn't. The next season was worse. You went home to Leech Lake to work for the tribe, and I went south in wind. I am still crazy. I know there is something larger than the memory of a dispossessed people. We have seen it. Try this. I usually play with my band, not by myself. But this next piece is a love poem. Actually, the next three are kind of. One is for a granddaughter. And this one takes place in Washington, D.C. And, you know, Washington, D.C. is a very loaded symbol and place for Indian people in this country. So it was amazing to find this there. And the song I'm going to play is a traditional Lakota women's love song. The hours we counted precious were blackbirds in the density of Washington. Taxis toured the labyrinth with passengers of mist, as the myth of ancient love took the shape of two figures carrying the dawn tenderly on their shoulders to the shores of the Potomac. We fled the drama of lit marble in the Capitol for a refuge held up by sweet everlasting earth. The man from Ghana who wheeled our bags was lonesome for his homeland, but commerce made it necessary to carry someone else's burdens. The stars told me how to find us in this disorder of systems. Washington did not ever sleep that night in the sequence of eternal nights. There were whirring calculators, computers stealing names, while spirits of the disappeared drank coffee at an all-night cafe in the city of disturbed relativity. Justice is a story by heart in the beloved country where imagination weeps. The sacred mountains only appear to be asleep. When we finally found the room in the hall of mirrors, I could no longer bear the beauty of scarlet licked with yellow on the wings of blackbirds. This is the world in which we undress together. Within it, white deer intersect with the wisdom of the hunter of grace. Horses wheel toward the morning star. Memory was always more than paper and cannot be broken by violent history or stolen by thieves of childhood. We cannot be separated in the loop of mystery between blackbirds and the memory of blackbirds. And in the pre-dawn, when we had slept for centuries in a drenching sweet rain, you touched me, and the springs of clear water beneath my skin were new knowledge. And I loved you in the city of death. Through the darkness and the sheer rise of clipped green grass and asphalt, our ancestors appear together at the shoreline of the Potomac, in their moccasins and pressed suits of discreet armor. They go to the water from the cars of smoky trains or dismount from horses dusty with fatigue. See the children who became our grandparents, the old women whose bones fertilize the corn. They form us in our sleep of exhaustion as we make our way through this world of skewed justice, of songs without singers. I embrace these spirits of relatives who always return to the place of beauty, whatever the outcome in the spiral of power. And I particularly admire the tender construction of your spine, which in the gentle dawning is a ladder between the deep in which stars are perfectly stars and the heavens where we converse with eagles. And I am thankful to the brutal city for the space which outlines your limber beauty. To the man from Ghana who also loves the poetry of the stars. To the ancestors who do not forget us in the concrete and paper illusion. To the blackbirds who are exactly blackbirds. And to you, sweetheart, as we make our incredible journey.
So you've been listening to CKUT 90.3 on the FM dial. That was Joy Harjo, poet, musician, playwright, author. She's the incumbent United States Poet Laureate, the first Native American to hold that honor. She is from a member of the Miskoke Nation and belongs to the Okefofa. She is an important figure in the second wave of the literary Native American Renaissance of the 20th century, all according to Wikipedia. Coming up is a conversation with Sherman Alexie, also from the University of California Lunchtime Poetry Series. Here it is.
Welcome to UCSD Guestbook.
Thanks.
I guess I'd like to start by asking you a little bit about your childhood.
My childhood? I was small. I grew up on the Spokane Indian Reservation, a town called Wahpeton, Washington, in eastern Washington State, right on the Idaho-Washington border. So I'm a Rez kid. Can still talk that way when I want to.
When you want to.
Yeah, so, and I grew up in a family, a fairly large family. We're Catholic and Indian, so guilt squared. And so there are three brothers, three sisters. My dad was the Catholic. My mom was sort of a Protestant Assembly of God's traditionalist Spokane, anti-Catholic, agnostic, atheist, pantheistic, Jesuit, matriarch. So it was quite diverse. But my dad, more than Catholic, worshiped basketball. So George Mikan was his pope. So that's where I grew up.
So how did this mix of ethnicities, religions, small towns, eastern Washington end up shaping your artistic career?
Well, I think what it prepared me for was to always be the outsider on American culture. In some sense, I was an outsider on my reservation because I was immediately interested in all sorts of things people around me weren't. You know, I was reading very young, you know, reading literature very young, Steinbeck and Shakespeare and poetry and Pound and Eliot and Keats and Yeats and sort of was looking that way from a very early age. Part of that has to do with my dad was a serious reader. He was a genre reader. I mean, I was the world's youngest JFK conspiracy theorist, you know, get my little Legos out and do Dealey Plaza and have a Weeble for JFK, you know, back and to the left, back and to the left. And but because I didn't fit in there, and because I didn't fit in the white world either, and I was always observing it. I mean, my reservation, unlike a lot of reservations, especially here in Southern California, is very much a monoculture. About 97% of the people who live on the Spokane Indian Reservation are Indian, and about 70% of those Indians are Spokane Indians. So it was a monoculture. And so I was always looking at the outside world, not a part of it, looking. So in some sense, it prepared me to always be a witness to the various felonies and misdemeanors of American life.
It puts you in a very interesting situation within your own Spokane culture and also within sort of Indian culture and America in general, because you're sort of the outsider, you're the critic of both cultures, and I guess it gets you into trouble sometimes too.
Well, it's supposed to get me in trouble. That always amazes me. I guess part of it is because from a traditional standpoint, in Native communities, at least in the way we look at it, I don't know if it was true or not. You know, who knows what the role of the artist in Indian community was 400 years ago? Right. Who really knows? We don't know. We only have guesses. But traditionally speaking, you know, the artist was part of the life, the day-to-day life, so that, you know, the Indian storyteller 400 years ago was no important than the Indian medicine man or the Indian hunter or the Indian warrior. They were all sort of equal roles in this tribalistic, socialistic, communistic community. And the Western idea of the artist has always been someone very separate, someone who was always distanced away from the tribe, whatever that tribe might be, and was always looking at it rather than being a part of the tribe. So being an Indian writer or an artist of any form these days, 21st century USA, you're always working in two very mutually exclusive roles, as an Indian writer and as a writer, and there's a lot of conflicts always. In some sense, artists always betray their tribes. So an Indian artist's betrayal is exponentially worse.
That's an interesting concept. I mean, in one sense, you have, you know, the role, and we don't know, as you said, exactly what it was like, but the sort of contrary person who was built into Indian society and played a defined role where the art, that definition of an Indian artist didn't quite fit in. But you also have the role of being an artist in the sort of Western sense. How do you think have your art sort of speak to both audiences at the same time as both critic, insider, and outsider?
Well, you know, I don't know about audience. You can never predict that. You don't know. You know, I first published my first book of poems from Hanging Loose Press, this tiny little press in Brooklyn, New York, with two Jews, an Irish man, and a mutt. How do you know that this little Indian boy's book's going to go where? And I thought, you know, I'd sell 200 copies, 196 to my mom. So I've never really figured out what the audience is, except that the audience for literature in this country is, in fact, for books, period, is about 70% middle-class white women. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we're all talking to middle-class white women. That's our job. You know, that's my audience.
No, but in one hand, you do all sorts of things. You do poetry, you've done music, you do film scripts, all sorts of projects besides the novels and the short stories. That's a tremendous amount of versatility, and clearly you've established an audience for all those things. So you must have some idea of what ties all those various art forms together in your mind.
An obsessive compulsive disorder.
Okay, well, that's sort of a good way to say it.
Every story finds its way of being told. I just never wanted to feel limited. I'm not limited in what I enjoy to read or watch. You know, I watch every high art, low art, pop art. I read everything from murder mysteries to, you know, esoteric literary theory. I watch everything from, you know, Friends to, you know, John Cassavetes movies. And I read everything from comic books to the latest, you know, romance novels. So, I mean, hunger is my crime. And I don't want to exclude myself from writing in all of these genres that I also love to read.
The other thing that strikes me, and I think you've said it before, is that there is something about your art in particular, and in some ways Indian artists as a genre, that is inherently political. Although, as you've also said before, you don't like to beat people over the head with it. But
I said that? I don't know. I like beating people over the head.
Okay, but you said you didn't beat people over the head.
No, I think I like to make them laugh first, and then beat them over the head.
And that's probably a very good way of doing it.
Yeah, they're defenseless.
But at the base, I wonder whether you think whether you feel that there is a responsibility among non-Indians, in a sense, to understand the Indian voice and how you approach that.
You know, I'm trying harder and harder, and as the years go by, not to separate the work that way. You know, we spend our lives trying to prove, Indians and Indian writers trying to prove that we're part of American culture, but we don't need to prove it. We already are. You know, our culture, our stories, our lives influence American life on a minute-by-minute basis. And it's not that it doesn't exist, it's people's refusal to recognize it. I mean, whenever you say the name of a town anywhere in this country, you're saying an Indian word.
Particularly in the West. Yeah.
Yes, and when you repeat that word, you know, there's so much context and subtext and history in that word that our lives and stories are everywhere. So I don't feel separate from that.
Right, and actually I was asking the question in reverse, which is sort of how does one make people in this country a little bit more self-conscious about the way they use those things?
I don't know, and I don't really care. It's not my job, you know. My job is to write and tell stories, and whatever happens after that I have no control over, and I don't have the ego or the insecurity to care. I mean, I have plenty of ego and plenty of insecurities, but not in that way. As the career has gone on, I just realized there's no way you can predict what happens with stories, and that's the great part. You know, that's the excitement of standing up in front of who knows who comes to your readings. You never know. I mean, these days I have a big enough career to where 5,000 people show up, right? But also, I'm a literary writer, so sometimes 50 people show up. You never know, and you never know the demographics. Sometimes it's, you know, 70% brown faces. Sometimes it's 100% white faces. You know, so it's the excitement of telling stories and the way in which the demographics of the audience change the way I feel about the evening, change the way the story gets told, it's an interpretation. I mean, you take, for example, like Smoke Signals, the movie we made. It changed radically depending on the audience.
Absolutely.
I mean, we screened it in Minnesota at the university, and the crowd was about 75% Indian, mm-hmm. and the sound on the film kept breaking down. But there was enough Indians in the crowd who had seen the movie enough times that they started filling in the dialogue. So it was like Rocky Horror Indian Picture Show. And it, you know, it was amazing. And yet, I've also been in theaters where it was screened for 100% white audiences in the East Coast where nobody laughed through the entire movie. Not one joke was understood or interpreted as a joke. And we screened it on my reservation. And we had to play it immediately a second time because people laughed so much during the first screening that they missed out on the story. You know, everybody yelling, there's my cousin, and cameo appearances. So that's the joy of storytelling and the pain and agony and the magic and loss of it, that it changes all the time, and it's kinetic. And as much as we attempt to define it, it's useless.
Well, let me ask you about Smoke Signals. It's one more story about audience, and we can beat this dead horse once more. Because, I mean, it's an interesting movie in all sorts of ways, and also as an Indian-made movie that was released by a sort of major Hollywood house, it also broke new ground. And it was a success. It made money. So in all respects, you know, you have the setup for Hollywood saying, wow, there's more here than, you know, we've thought of in terms of sort of real Indian-made pictures. But do you think
do you think they get it? No. There's no getting it or not getting it. That's not even the issue. The issue is this going to make enough money for us to make this movie? It has nothing to do with whether they get it or not.
Right, but then they make more if there is enough, and there was no.
According to their definitions and their pie charts and graphs and formulas, no. Smoke Signals wasn't enough of a success. And moreover, I think that even though it was one of the most successful independent movies of 1998, in the top five money-wise, and for gross compared to budget, one of the most successful movies of the year, mm-hmm. period. But because it is filled with Indians and is an Indian story, it does have a ceiling. Mm-hmm. It does have an economic ceiling. And because it has an economic ceiling, I mean, I guarantee you, there's no movie about Indians ever going to break out and make $50 or $100 million.
And never. That's what they're looking for.
Yeah, it's never. There's no movie going to win that lottery. I'd be amazed if one did. I'd be so happy, but it's not going to happen, and they know that.
Well, then that brings us back to your stories, which are the core of the whole thing. What goes into thinking through what you want to talk about? Is it something that just comes out? Is it something that you reach for? Is it something that develops over years?
I have no idea.
Something that happens quickly?
I have no idea. I could lie. You know, I could tell you some stories about how it works, you know. Oh, I sit there and wait for the muse to come.
There you go.
You know, I work my ass off, you know. You know, I sit in front of the computer and pound away, or with my notebook and write away, you know. It's about manual labor.
Yeah, and I think that's actually the message about artists, that it's manual labor.
Yeah, it's nothing ethereal. Right. And nothing gets me madder than some writer or artist sitting on a program like this and getting all esoteric and ethereal about the process. Like, they have been chosen by the gods to tell these stories. No, I work just as hard as NFL linebacker or a plumber or a police officer, you know. And I think you'll find that the more successful the writer, the harder they work, as in any field. Yeah. The more dedicated and disciplined they are. And that's what I am. I'm dedicated and disciplined.
So you also spend a lot of time meeting other audiences, meeting other people, and do you get stories out of that? Is that where some of your...
Well, I mean, I try not to, because I don't want to be a thief of other people's experiences. You see that all the time, and I'm like, for instance, September 11th, since the Trade Center, the Pentagon bombings, I don't know how many requests I've received to write about it. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, there must be 10 anthologies and 50 or 60 magazines have contacted me. You know, now certainly I can have an opinion about why it happened and the response to it, in terms of policy, in terms of politics and world affairs, but you know, it's not my story to tell. I watch TV and I see all these journalists and politicians and military leaders going on and on about this or that campaign, and I just want them to shut up and put on the people who actually lost lives here, here and there, you know, survivors. And so you know, I try not, you know, when I hear somebody's story or somebody tells me something interesting or amazing, I try to be content with that story, with just hearing it and knowing it and making it a part of my life in that private way.
Right.
But my public expression, I always try to be the originator, you know, and of course you can't control that. Sometimes you're not sure where it came from, some remembered piece of conversation or some altered memory that you think happened to you but was really somebody else's. And you do steal from your own family, certainly. I don't have any qualms about, you know, stealing from my immediate relatives. But I try not to take away from strangers.
So I'm also interested in many of the works that I've read, both the short stories. In novels like Indian Killer, there's, you know, a tremendous amount of humor, a tremendous amount of sort of investigation of the interface between white and Indian lives, and often very intimate and particularly in your most recent set of short stories.
A lot of sex.
Yeah. And in interesting ways, in ways that most readers of anything Indian haven't really thought about. So I'm interested in sort of where you think that comes from, the sort of juxtaposition, the kind of...
I've had sex with white people.
Well, okay. That's, on the face of it, that makes perfect sense. But normally wouldn't interrogate that as a necessarily intellectual endeavor. But actually, it gets to my issue, and that is that is in some way what you're looking at, what you're asking about is how things that are received as sort of normal are made. More interesting when they're interrogated, or what is it that?
Oh gosh, getting all academic on me.
It's my job.
I know you're showing off your degrees. Interrogate. What are you, a homicide detective or a professor? I don't know. It's almost. If I want to get metaphorical, I get itches. And you scratch him, right? I'm still, in some sense, in terms of the last book, Devastating in the World, which was a lot had to do with interracial relationships between whites and Indians, I'm still trying to figure that out about myself, those conflicting desires I have about whiteness. Mm-hmm. I'm married to an Indian woman, mm-hmm. but most of the love partners in my life, in fact, 99%, have been white. Mm-hmm. And most of my objects of adoration from afar have been white. And why is that?
And of course it works both ways, and you explore it both ways.
Right. And also, in some sense, as a public figure, as a writer, as a literary celebrity in various forms, experiencing the ways in which I get objectified and I get turned into a fetish, I become a turquoise laid Kachina doll, and so that always really interests me too, and the ways in which we consciously and unconsciously accept that. In the end, everything we all do is to get laid, right? And so I wrote a book about that.
Right. I mean, again, I'm not trying not to get too academic, but there is an interesting analogy that occurs to me. I mean, we're here on land that was Kumeyaay, and that could be said anywhere in the United States. It was someone else's land.
Yeah.
And the way in which the 18 Indian reservations and groups here, and it's the largest number of any county in the United States, exist is in a more or less invisible state, except for in certain objectified areas like mm-hmm. casinos and whatnot. And there is a kind of interesting analogy between the investigation of the interracial sex that you're talking about and the way in which whiteness makes Indianness invisible, yet uses all sorts of cultural and icons and ideas in its fabric. So I'm wondering whether this is a stand-in for something else, or
oh well, I don't know. I mean, in the sense, as you ask that question, all I can think of response is, I mean, what is colonialism except the breeding out of existence of the colonized?
Right.
And how is that accomplished?
Right. And it's exactly those desires that, in some sense,
right. I mean, the most dangerous thing for Indians then, now, and forever, is always going to be the fact that we love our colonizers, and we do, and we are disappearing, and we will disappear, and what Indian is 100 years from now would be unrecognizable to the Indians of today.
And 100 years before compared to today.
And here in Southern California, I mean, Indian tribes are the United Nations, and virtually indistinguishable from the community at large. And more and more with every generation, the difference is purely cultural. And in fact, purely adopted cultural rather than innate culture. That the originators of the ceremonies and stories don't exist anymore, and that the direct descendant carriers of those stories and ceremonies don't exist anymore, that Indian culture has always received knowledge, and that's going to continue. Does that mean these people aren't Indian? No.
Right.
It just means the colonization is complete.
Right. But and it's precisely those issues that seem to always come out of the stories, no matter how personal and how autobiographical they seem.
But the thing, and it's not just Indians either. I mean, every novel is about identity.
Right.
What does Salman Rushdie say? There are two stories, the story of home and the story of leaving home. That's all. That's all that exists in the world. And every novel, every poem, every movie is about that. And I just have an Indian spin on it, and a Spokane Indian spin at that.
Right. Well, I guess I'd like to just see. I'm always asked about Indian authors, Indian writers, both now and in the past. And I'm wondering, besides Sherman Alexie, what other young Indian artists, Indian writers would you send someone looking for to watch out for?
Well, we all know the usual suspects, and they're all still great. I mean, I've become a usual suspect. You know, I'm bored by myself. The one book I would talk about that's coming out, I just found this out yesterday. She's been working on it for years. And I had, last thing I heard from her, she goes, I'll never finish it. But it's coming out from Blue Hen Books. It's a division of Penguin, a novel called Permared by Deb Erling. She's a Flathead Indian, Salish Kootenai cousin of mine. And I think it's something brand new in Indian fiction. And then another writer, a Chippewa Indian named Mark Turcotte, has a new book of poems coming out soon. It's amazing. It's amazing. It's something brand new. Indian literature is still very adolescent. I mean, my family, I'm only the second generation to ever put pen to paper with any regularity. Mm-hmm. And you find the same as the case with a lot of other Indian writers. But what's happening now is for most of the century, and we've only really been engaged in what you call literature this century, most of the Indian writers have been very privileged from very academic, very upper class families. And that's changing now, that in much the same way that the beginning of literature in Europe and the beginning of literature anywhere has always been the privileged start, mm-hmm. because they're the ones who get taught to read and write. And it starts making its way down. And it's making its way down now. And blue-collar Indians are starting to write more and more. I mean, Mark works as a, you know, is a carpenter and a logger. So I think that's what's going to happen now, is the literature is going to diversify, because those practicing it and getting published are more diverse.
Yeah, and there clearly is an audience and a market for Indian literature, and that changes, unlike...
Yep, we can get just as ignored as every other writer of every other color.
Right. Well, that's interesting. I guess one might sort of end in asking you what kinds of projects you have on the table that you're excited about.
Well, our new movie, The Business of Fancy Dancing, just got accepted into Sundance, and will be premiering in January of 2002. Oh, my gosh. 2002.
Soon.
Very soon. In the American Spectrum section. So it's the second movie, and we shot it on DV, and we shot it very tribally, very collaboratively, and you know, more than half the people who worked on it were women. So, you know, we tried to be matriarchal about filmmaking. So.
And another unusual practice.
Exactly. Yeah. Filmmaking is a serious boys' club, so I tried to, you know, change that a bit.
And what about the poetry championships?
I retired from heavyweight poetry bout.
You're
because
not heavyweight.
Because it was sort of a Muhammad Ali Ken Norton fight, where Muhammad Ali got the win, the decision, but he actually lost, and I was Muhammad Ali and Saul Williams was Ken Norton for this last bout. I thought he won, even though I got the decision, so I retired, because I couldn't carry on morally and ethically knowing I had lost. So Saul's going to continue.
Well, that's great. And for music, are you at further musical
interviews? I'm doing everything. I'm working on 10 books and, you know, taking all my pills.
So.
Well, that's great. Maybe I should get some of those pills.
You had no response to that. That was interesting. No deconstructing?
I've been deconstructed completely.
Okay.
I guess, the proper end of the interview. Sherman, I want to thank you very much for appearing at UCSD and Guestbook.
Well, thank you.
So you've been listening to the conversation with Sherman Alexie. Sherman Alexie is a Spokane Coeur d'Alene American novelist, a short story writer, poet, and filmmaker. His writings draw on his experiences as an Indigenous American with ancestry from several tribes. He grew up on the Spokane Indian Reservation and now lives in Seattle, Washington. His best known book is The Known Ranger and Tonto Fist Fight in Heaven, which is from 1993, a collection of short stories. And it was adapted as the film Smoke Signals in 1998. He's also, his first novel, Reservation Blues, received a 1996 American Book Award. And his first young adult novel, The Absolutely True Diary of a Part-Time Indian, is a semi-autobiographical novel that won the 2007 U.S. National Book Award for Young People's Literature. 2009 collection of short stories and poems, War Dances, won the 2010 Penn Faulkner Award for Fiction. And he's also the guest editor for the 2015 Best American Poetry. So that concludes this week's edition of Dromotext. We'll be back next week with another hour-long presentation of the spoken word. You've been listening to CKUT 90.3 on the FM dial. Till next week.
I went to residential school. I was just 8 years old.
Gayla Kasla. My name is Gennarji O'Sullivan of the Tlaalitsis Nation, originally from Turner Island. You're listening to Wendell exploring the legacy of Indian residential schools.
Jason White Bear is one of our youngest panelists. He is a residential school survivor.
Gaki Waku Maganak, Nadi, Wendin Naganag. How Matakiwas. I said all my relations in three different languages. Those languages were taken away and given with this one here that I've mastered in residential school. And they told me that once you go there, he says, you're not going to come home with this anymore. You're not going to come home being able to speak Nehewewan. You're not going to be able to speak. But when you do go, what I want you to do is I want you to try and master everything that they give you so that they can never fool us anymore. In my generation, we're at the point now where we understand the nuances between the languages. We can say, bonjour, Anin. I wish I knew a little bit of Arab, but you know, the point being is that we're all sitting around here and we're very learned people. We're very knowledgeable. We know how to say, tukizivi, inuklitut, ginauvit. You know, to say a little bit of each other's language nowadays. And that's just us as this language, as this. And I think that's a direct result of residential school, is because we always ask each other, where are you from? Well, how do you say this? How do you say that? So that when you run into somebody else, you're allowed to respect them and say, Tanse, how? Wuju anin. So regardless of what was taken away from me during my residential school formative years, I haven't lost the ability to see. And so it is with this that I thank each and every one of you. I'd like to say Ninanaskamun, Gakyogi Gwayotsi Wataaski. And that's Cree for I'm grateful for everything in this land. I had to learn that from a kukum, because I was speaking in front of chiefs one time and I said, I can't speak the language. So she taught me that little bit. Ninanaskamutaman, Gakyogi Gwayotsi Wataaski. Hi, hi. Thank you.
You have just heard At Window exploring the legacy of Indian residential schools. Both my mother and I attended St. Michael's Residential School in Alert Bay, BC. This is a part of a larger project called Resonating Reconciliation that engages community radio as a tool to help define what reconciliation is. Resonating Reconciliation is meant to help reconcile all Canadians to this shared history. This is the work of the National Campus and Community Radio Association, the Red Jam Slam Society, and this station. Resonating Reconciliation is also supported by the Indian Residential School Survivor Society and is funded by the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. To hear more, go to www.ncra.ca/resonating.
Fuggo Vale.
Today, ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to Andre and Max of the Deadly Snakes plugging each other with a peg leg. In Montreal, Andre and Max of the Deadly Snakes.
CKUT 90.3 FM.
Show pour le monster. Show pour le monster. Show pour le monster. Show pour le monster.
Bonsoir, mesdames et messieurs, bienvenue à Show pour le Monstant. Vous êtes à l'antenne de CKUT 90.3. Je m'appelle Nicolas Terrier. Je serai votre Sherpa pour la soirée, car ensemble nous allons escalader une fois de plus le Monstant. Alors j'espère que vous avez vos cordes, vos souliers d'escalade et votre mousqueton, vos mousquetons et votre piolet. Je vous invite à monter, en fait, et on va flotter vers le haut du Monstone. On va même pas l'escalader, on va juste flotter vers le sommet. Qu'est-ce que vous en dites?
Allez, c'est...